have a friend that has an omnidirectional antenna on the ground, and he has radials beneath the surface. So, you know, that's another way of doing it. I mean, if there's a better way to have an NFED, I never heard of a vertical NFED, so educate me. If there is one, I would like to research it.
Yeah, you can orient a NFED halfway vertically. It'll have a different radiation pattern, but it will work theoretically just as good as a horizontal. Antennas don't really know from horizontal and vertical. The only thing that's going on is their interaction with Earth ground. So another way of phrasing it, and I mentioned this years ago here on the Technical Net, that if you put an antenna up in space, how do you tell if it's horizontal or vertical oriented?
Wasn't there a polarization?
Yeah, but it's not horizontal or vertical polarization, because that's all in relation to Earth ground, and you're not anywhere near Earth ground. You're in outer space.
Okay, so what would be an example of an NFED vertical?
I'm sure that there are antennas that operate as NFED J-poles. J-poles are basically NFED with the J-stub acting as a impedance-transforming device. So that's a vertically oriented NFED half-wave.
But how does it actually, how long is it if it's vertical?
It's a half wave NFED. It's a half wave long.
Right, but if you're going vertical, how tall is the actual antenna? I'm trying to conceptualize this.
Have you ever seen a J-pole antenna for UHF and VHF usually? That's what I'm talking about. I don't exactly remember the length, but it's a half wave length from top to bottom.
You mean where it wraps around the top horizontally like an oval?
No, it's a straight piece of copper pipe. Have you ever seen a J-pole?
You ever seen an antenna? I'll look it up. No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. It's a very common UHF-VHF antenna. A lot of people like them. They have a very low profile. They're easy to maintain. They're not terribly efficient either, again, because they're NFED, but still. But take a look at it. It's possible to orient any vertical antenna horizontally. The only problem is mechanical, because we live in a gravitational field. But if we didn't live in a gravitational field, there wouldn't be much meaning to the concept of horizontal versus the vertical. Because, again, these are descriptions related to how they are physical in relationship to an Earth ground.
Right now, and I get the concept. I get the concept. I just don't know how you could actually truly go ahead and get out on it, because it's relatively small.
EAV. I see. I'm saying your suffix instead of your first name, because we have two Eds, as you stated.
This is Ed from TGJE. I'll tell you the dimensions of my J-pole.
Smaller than that. In space, the resolve of the lever by everything is surface polarized. It's half-wise polarization. And so you don't have more polarization problems. I'm also hearing some stuff about internal fundamentals. If anybody has any questions about the fundamentals, I'll be glad to take them. What I'm having trouble with is all of the names everybody's playing going off the fundamentals. And as a general rule, the rule is to match the impedance, and in some cases, manage the pattern. But very rare that ham radios, other than Yahoo, try to be particularly directional, so the pattern isn't anywhere near as important as matching the impedance.
Well, I mean, most N-fed half waves have either a small inductor or a small capacitor that because otherwise, as you go through the multiple frequencies, you drift out of the ham band. So by putting that discrete component in the right place with the right value, you kind of maintain those harmonics. But again, this isn't really Jim's question because Jim wants to use it as a monoband device for 160 meters. And I'm trying to kind of keep it within the limitations of his question, just to see if we could get other people who have other opinions. I think it all kind of comes down to kind of a different version of the same thing that I've been saying. That, under some circumstances, you might be able to trick physics with virtual antennas in perfectly grounded lakes and oceans and such, but otherwise, physics, the antenna will grab some counterpoise. Might not be the most obvious, might not be the prettiest, but in a rainy day, what have you. So, GJE, you wanted to say something? Unfortunately, you doubled with EAV.
Sorry, I could give you the dimensions of my J-pole.
Okay, sure. I mean, J-poles are kind of well-known antennas that a lot of people like them. Some people don't. It's a free country. I still remember QSD had an April Fool's edition where they invented what they called the Q-pole, because instead of looking like the letter J, they took some plumbing pipes and twisted them into looking like Q's. But sure, give us the dimensions.
Okay, K2GJE. The short leg is 19 1/4 inches in height, and the long leg is 5 1/2 inches away, and the long leg is 57 1/2 inches, which is about 3/4 of a wavelength at 2 meters over.
Okay, but I mean it operates as an N-fed half wave. The extra plumbing, I don't know if yours is copper pipe, but a lot of them are copper pipe. The remaining amount of copper pipe is what's being used to impedance match it.
Correct.
This is not copper pipe. This is just tubing, steel tubing, plated, I guess, whatever they plated with, zinc or something, so it can weather a little bit. And it's a 2 meter J-pole.
Yeah, fine. Most of the ones I've seen tended to be copper because they use plumbing pipe. But yeah, you could use any conductor. It doesn't even have to be a pipe. I think Brian wanted to say something.
I correct myself. I absolutely know what a J-pole is. And actually, what confused me is because I'm saying to myself, it's the antenna I'm thinking of, okay, it's used for VHF, UHF, not HF. So I know what a J-pole antenna is for VHF, UHF, but I've never heard of a J-pole for HF.
Well, like
VHF.
Yes, Jim?
Roy, I thank you very much for the time. This has been wonderful. If you want to cut it off, please do go to another conversation. But I guess I came to the conclusion that the simplification of my question is, if a quarter wave radiator is half an antenna, why isn't a half wave radiator a full antenna?
It is.
And I guess that's the heart of my question.
It is.
Frequency divided by
length. Yeah. But you still need a counterpoise. It's not a balanced antenna. It's an unbalanced antenna, and you have to deal with it like any other unbalanced antenna.
Can I give an example?
Sure.
Since World War II, airplanes have been dropped in shaft to jam radars. And a shaft consists of little strips of aluminum foil cut to specific lengths.
And the lens is critical. They have to know the frequency of the enemy radar, and the strips are cut as half the wave at that length. And because it's just this halfway strip, it makes a perfect reflection at that frequency only. And typically, since there are different enemy radars, they have a different length. But each one is designed to jam a particular enemy radar from saying half the wave, the harvest strip with nothing else, is an excellent reflector. And that just proves the concept of how critical half the wavelength is as an antenna, and everything else falls out from there.
Okay, but I mean, you're not quite talking about a standard receiver transmitter antenna. You're kind of just as a parasitic element of re-reflecting RF radar signals.
Exactly. I didn't say it's practical for him. I just said it illustrates the point of just how important half the wave is.
Okay, I'll give you that. Yes, Brian?
You could take a off-center fed dipole, okay? Let's say on one band. Let's say, for example, you want to do it on 20 meters, okay? You could make that off-center fed perfectly resonant, okay, on one particular band, okay? Perfectly resonant, you know, one-to-one with the SWR. But, I mean, you have to have the correct length of wire. It's a little bit of trial and error and a little bit of, you know, regular science, you know, in terms of the mathematics. So, I mean, it can be done.
A center-fed resonant dipole is resonant. You can take the same length of wire and slide the antenna feed off-center. And it will not change the resonance of that antenna. It will change, as we've mentioned many, many times, the impedance. The lowest impedance of a center-fed antenna, of a half-wave antenna, is at the center feed point, where it's anywhere from about 35 ohms to about 50 ohms of impedance. As you slide it to the right or to the left, the resonance should stay pretty much the same, but the impedance goes up, and you now have to match that non-50-ohm impedance in order for your antenna system to work correctly without undue reflection and decreased efficiency and energy transfer.
Totally agree.
Okay. Yes, Jeff? Yes,
right.
Jeff?
Yeah, that's not the beauty of the off-center fed dipole, of course. But you're impinging the voltage curve of higher bands from the apparent resonant band at a particular place, depending on where you decide to feed it, and fed with the appropriate length of open line or coax or whatever, with the appropriate balance, that antenna becomes useful on many different bands, starting with the band that it's half wave on. Everyone knows this, except apparently the other person who's talking about off-center feds. That's the beauty of the off-center fed. And it's even better if you make an off-center fed with a center load. And then there's an entire web page that talks about the physics of this, and it's an absolutely fantastic antenna QSL.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely, Jeff. It's just that I'm trying to really desperately limit the conversation to be within the range of Jim's question, because I find that we keep on leaking out to other things. And yes, a off-center fed has great qualities as a multiband antenna. But I simply wanted to address the fundamental statement that Brian made that suggested that as you move the feed point off-center, you change the resonance of the antenna. You don't. You change other qualities that allow it to be better at multi-band, but it still should be resonant at the fundamental frequency that it was when it was a center-fed dipole. I just wanted to kind of constrict the level of discussion so that we don't kind of fly off talking about all other interesting aspects of a lot of other antennas that weren't the basis for Jim's question.
Absolutely. I'll be quiet now.
I agree. I mean, basically, yeah, like, yeah, like Roy said, you know, if you move the center point of the antenna, you're going to be changing not the resonance, you're going to be changing the impedance. Totally agree on that.
PhD.
Yeah, Jim.
I admit to being guilty of having much glee with this conversation, because I'm finding it's a conversation about conversation almost more than it's a conversation about antennas.
Yes, it is. It's about veering off topic, and sometimes I like veering off topic because it kind of opens things to a lot of interesting discussion. But in the case of this one, since I would love to have other people kind of give you their view specifically of your question and not their own question. A lot of times people answer their own questions. I'm trying to get people to answer your question.
What is the original question?
Again, the original question of Jim was, do you really need anything for a counterpoise? Shouldn't a half-wave NFED be enough, that you don't need anything to be anything like a radio or a counterpoise or any balancing device, that it's just kind of, it's already, you're using a full half-wave, which should be, which it's resonant at, why do you need a counterpoise? That, I think, was the sum total of Jim's question.
Phrase more simply where we've gone so far, if I still have it.
Sure.
The thought that if a quarter wave antenna is, if a quarter wave antenna element is half of the antenna, shouldn't a half wave element of wire be the full antenna? I think that's distilling the question to its essence, and I'd love the Ed's take on that.
Yeah, the only problem is how you see it.
A half wave gives us an impedance match.
I think I have the answer.
Okay, here's the answer.
And I emphasize, I think. So, if you have the off-center FET, and you take a couple of toroids, and put that on the coaxial side, okay, even if it's close to the transformer, it's going to prevent the RF from emanating, okay, to that point. In other words, from the transformer to the toroids, it's going to act as a choke. And the other radiation will be sent to the wire. Am I correct or am I incorrect?
Wait, are we talking about matching impedance or is there any pattern you want? Because radiation from all other places just changes the pattern.
I couldn't hear that.
Can I see this slowly, boys?
Yeah, please.
The comment with the toroids seems to be creating a more idealized antenna pattern, regardless of matching the impedance. With the two antennas, the ham radio used, the biggest thing is getting a impedance match, so the transmitter is happy. Anything that has to do with parts radiating, the places you don't want to radiate, has to do with distorts the overall antenna pattern from the ideal. By ham radio antennas, unless you have a very directional antenna like Yari, it doesn't really matter. I mean, a dipole has an antenna pattern that looks like a donut. A theoretically ideal isotropic antenna and turn pattern looks like a ball. If you want to contact somebody, does it really matter what kind of a blob your turn pattern is?
Okay, did you get that, Brian?
Kind of yes and no, and it's my ears, not the operator. Maybe, Roy, if you could just go ahead and just clarify that for me.
I say the plane, it's not your ears, it's my mouth.
Ed is telling, is asking you if you're involved, if this line of discussion is more related to radiation pattern, and he suggested that ultimately, beyond a certain point, radiation pattern, if you get to the other guy, is immaterial. I'm not quite sure if that's what you were alluding to. I was kind of lost with the transmission line and coax and balance. And toroids. I mean, toroids are in the 49-to-1 balun, but toroids could also be the ferrites that are being used as RF chokes. And again, if you RF choke right at the very feed point, you're going to kind of undermine the operation of an end-fed half wave. If you choke it a couple of feet away, that probably is sufficient counterpoise for this particular antenna to deal with things. But even though it's a full half wave of radiating antenna, it's sort of like if you had a seesaw. You know, I often use the seesaw analogy. And you sort it in half, it would be a terrible seesaw. So then let's take the two halves of the seesaw, let's bolt them together, but pivot them at the end of the two seesaw planks. So now you got a twice as long seesaw plank on the right end and nothing on the left end. You still have a broken seesaw. It might be as long as the original seesaw, but having it pivot at the end instead of somewhere in the middle gives you a very unbalanced, unhappy kid with a broken seesaw.
Good analogy.
I love the analogy. Let me see if I got it.
I get the analogy.
I think it's a good analogy. The main thing is that you want a half-wave antenna, or any end-fed antenna. Why isn't a half-wave antenna a pull antenna? What am I missing?
A half-wave antenna is
not multi-band, not off-center-fed, not properly matched. Half wave, impedance matched, choked. Why is that not a full antenna when a half wave dipole or a quarter wave whip on a car with the counterpoise of the car body or ground plane antenna, quarter wave whip with the radials is representing the other half of the antenna? Why isn't the half wave a full antenna? I don't think we've hit on this at all. And had so much conversation. Thank you, Roy, for tolerating my act. I'm enjoying this technically and socially tremendously. And if it's too much to bear, let's talk about something else.
Roy, I answer this question.
Yes, Ed. Please do.
A half wavelength of wire, or whatever, is a full half-wave, dipole, antenna. It is how you fuse the energy into it and the impedance. You fuse the energy in the center and it was a fantastic coincidence that fit the impedance, so now your transmitter is happy and you're done. If you want to impedance, you have a much higher impedance. So how do you knock down the SWR? And that's what all of this nonsense we're talking about is how you knock down the SWR. Period.
Well, I mean, to a degree. Unfortunately, once again, you know, we're very interested in things that we can measure. And because it's very easy to measure SWR, we're all kind of fixated on it. We don't care about efficiency because we have no real way of measuring efficiency. So I think that's unfortunately a limitation with us as being human beings in our environment. But you still, it's still not enough to impedance match an end-fed half-wave if you're not going to supply it without anything you can kind of use as a counterpoise. because that's important in the efficiency of an antenna. Wouldn't you agree, Ed?
I don't believe that's necessary. Certain antennas need a counterpoise, but they're not complete antennas. A half-length length of wire is a complete antenna. Like I said, the shaft is halfway the antenna. The problem is there's no need to feed them. It's impossible to feed them. The counterpoise is not by definition necessary. Counterpoises, I've seen, are only to be a substitute for missing ground plane. If you have an antenna and you don't have an adequate ground plane, counterpoises can be the answer. But I find them infuriatingly difficult to get them to do what I want. So I've kind of given up on them for anything. But maybe that's my fault. Maybe I'm just biased. But the point I'm saying is, the problem is, as soon as there's something you want down, the ham radio antenna, good done. With a basic simple ham radio antenna, the pattern is what the pattern is, and smart controller is a waste of time when you should have usually it's in a house surrounded by trees with aluminum grain cutters, and all it is to start the best of the kind of pattern, but why even try?
Comment?
Yes, please.
Hey, ACTPO. Yeah, Roy, I think I see what the problem is. We're talking about the difference between feeding a balanced antenna and feeding an unbalanced antenna. I believe that's the fundamental difference between the two cases that the original question addresses.
Perhaps, but I find that as time goes on, people start to use different words for counterpoises. You know, we were talking about no counterpoises, and then someone brings up, well, but what about radials? Well, radials are counterpoises. And now Ed's mentioning ground plane. Well, what's ground plane? It's another counterpoise. So all these things are different ways to imagine fundamentally the same physical aspect in antenna theory, that you need something acting as either a radial, a counterpoise, or a ground plane. And I don't know. I seem to not be able to get that the thought across.
I said it's that bipole does not really need a ground plane.
H-E-2-R-1.
Yes, very good. Would you like to?
Hello, good evening,
yeah,
everyone. Ed, you got to try to bring up the mic gain on your radio. So I want to have to turn up the volume when you speak. But I just want to say that I have a fan dipole made by Alpha Delta. I feed into an external tuner in the shack or the tuner in the radio. I choose which one I want to use. And when I'm transmitting, you know, I can see the level of SWR, and I can see the amount of output, the modulation of a single sideband. And I know when I'm getting out, and I know when I'm not getting out.
Amen.
Well, I have an answer pending for Roy. Am I okay, Roy?
Okay.
Where is the ground plane on Yahi?
On a what?
On Yahi Ula Array.
I can't quite make that out. I'm sorry, Ed.
A beam antenna. Named after a Japanese engineer, Yahi. But if you want to be sure you're not being his boss, Yahi Ula Array. A beam antenna does not have or need a ground plane.
No, because it's a balanced antenna.
Oh, okay. You want to say about that. I guess you have two emotions.
Comment.
Yeah, comment.
Fan dipole hex beam. All of those are beautiful antennas. Why? Because they're balanced.
Okay, but again, that wasn't the question. The question was in an infed half-wave. Again, there are hundreds of different models of antenna, all with their own good features and limitations and what have you. And we could talk to it about it, thankfully, late into the night. But I just, for the sake of Jim, who came back for a second week of this, wanted to kind of constrict the conversation to the subset of an antenna that he was interested in and has and wants to know more about. That's what I'm trying to get across.
AG2RY?
I have a resource.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Yes, David?
That NFIT half-wave antenna. Is there a tuner on the antenna side for that to operate?
I think it's cut for 160 meters. I'll ask Jim, do you have an antenna tuner on it?
Well, a aforementioned antenna doesn't exist, but I could throw it up here in 5 minutes. But I got to figure out what I got to do at the end of it. Again, the question is simplified to, if a quarter wave is half an antenna and it needs another half in the form of a counterpoise, a car body, radials, counterpoise, isn't a half wave radiating element a whole antenna? And if it's properly choked and properly impedance matched, isn't it a whole antenna? Or am I missing something? And so far, nobody's pointed out we're missing something. They're talking about other things that are very interesting. I love the off-center dipole conversations. I love all that stuff. But if a quarter wave is half an antenna, isn't half a wave a full antenna? And if the answer is no, say so.
Comment.
And we could go talk about something simple, like, you know, global politics.
Okay. For the sake of amateur radio antennas that are not in the ocean or the lake, no, the answer is no. It's not a full functioning resident antenna for amateur radio on land.
Comment.
Yeah, Brian.
Okay, who posed the original question? The original question.
Jim.
Jim, do you hear me? KF2CC?
I do. What I just said was, tail a little bit, but what I asked is, is it a half-wave resonant piece of wire, a full antenna? So why does it need a counterpoise? Counterpoise is to create the other half of the antenna. Half-wave dipole has a the element soldered to the core of the coax, an element soldered or otherwise connected to the shield of the coax. You could do other fancy things involved, but the point is that's the heart, the simplest form of a dipole in a coax system. But if you consider that a quarter wave radiating element is half an antenna, why isn't a half wave radiating element a full antenna? And nobody's even proposed an answer to that, other than it doesn't work that way.
I'd like to respond.
Well, that's okay. I mean, we don't know. We don't know. I'm good with that. Lots of things I don't know, but nobody's even proposed an answer to that.
Jim, this is Brian, KF2CC. Do you hear?
I do, very much.
Okay. Do you belong to QRZ?
I think I signed up once. I have no idea what my... I probably couldn't access it today.
All right. If you log into QRZ, there is an operator. He's an expert electronic engineer in antennas. His call sign is WA7ARK. That's W as in water, A as in alpha, 7, alpha, radio, kite, and I'm not using the correct terminology, but WA7ARK. His name is Mike. He's an antenna expert. I would go ahead and send him a conversation or send him an email, okay, and explicitly go ahead and detail your question. I think he could give you the exact answer that you're looking for.
You know, you have some of the missing criteria right here, right now.
I agree. I totally agree. Go ahead. I'm waiting to hear from you more. You go ahead. Sorry, we'll jump over you, Roy.
KG2RY.
Yeah, guys, you can't just kind of talk over each other. You have to actually listen to what the other person says. The other person, being Jim, handed it off to Eddie AV. Now, you know, this might not be a protocol for a net controlled by me, but so be it. I'm always kind of relaxed on the rules. So EAV comes next. If you don't like or you're confused or you want to say something after EAV, that's fine, but give EAV a chance to say his thing.
Look, I am a election engineer. I've worked on dozens and dozens of contenders, some of which blistered the paint off the walls, both literally and figuratively. But I try not to appear like a massive twit, so I play it down. But let me put it this way. Some things in life are simple. You have a half-wave antenna, and you will figure out how to treat it so the transmitter is happy. You're done. All the rest is details.
Why, thank you. Back to Roy.
Okay, you know, I mean, it kind of is the very polite version of shut up, sit down. You know, I mean, the thing is that, you know, functionally speaking, you don't have to kind of worry too much about the counterpoise. If you don't take care of it, nature tends to take care of it as well. And, again, it's the nature of being balanced versus incredibly unbalanced. Without any kind of a counterpoise, it's a very unbalanced antenna, and the efficiencies go plummet to the ground. You don't need a great deal of a counterpoise. We talked about that before. A couple of feet will do. In some cases, people think a couple of inches will do. But you need something to act as a balance. It doesn't add the other, quote, the other half of the antenna, because obviously if you compare the dimensionality of many counterpoises, they're much, much smaller than the radiating leg of the you know, monopole that we call an NFED halfway. So that's the best that I could offer, is that it's not a functioning antenna because unless there's something else added to the mix, it's not a balanced antenna. And you want to have some kind of physics balance as far as currents and such in order for the radiations to occur and to produce RF, which is the point of the exercise.
A question for your Roy.
Sure.
There is a company called myantennas.com. That's myantennas.com. And they claim, and I've heard a couple of other people who've had their antennas substantiate this, and these are NFED antennas, that you're able to go ahead with his technique of implementing the antenna that he's selling, that you do not need an auto tuner, that you could use the tuner in your radio up to a 3-to-1 ratio. How do you explain that?
I don't even understand the question. You could use a 3-to-1 capable internal antenna tuner on anything. It may work or it may not work. Theoretically, if you build a very nice NFED half wave with a little bit of an inductor on the side to correct for the multiple frequencies of a multiband, you may get away with not requiring a antenna tuner. Or a relatively low-power antenna tuner like most internal antenna tuners, especially Japanese, that are kind of designed to deal with 3-to-1 maximum. But, you know, not everyone has the right mount for these NFEDs. They touch a bunch of things. They're off specs, and you might need a stronger antenna tuner. I don't think he can guarantee it. He'll probably say that if you don't aren't able to tune it with a 3-to-1, you can send it back for a refund. But that's not a, you know that anyone can kind of offer that type of a refund. But I mean, it's a best case scenario, and you know, some people just don't have best case scenarios.
Right, but what you said, use at the end an inductor. What inductor would you use, for example?
It's kind of a black art. A capacitor will do as well. You have to kind of test it out, and you can't plug it into an equation. So, you know, guys who are actually trying to do this, they pass on, you know, how he turns, what diameter, or, you know, and if it's not working right, they'll change the winding because it's part of the antenna anyway. And they do experimentation. When it comes to things like inductors, it's very difficult to calculate because, surface area and all kinds of things that you can't really simply calculate. So it's more practical. You wind something and you see how it works in the field and you adjust accordingly.
KD2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Roy, I have to compliment you on your extraordinary ability to run a net in adverse conditions. I've enjoyed the conversation, but I know it's been frustrating on a few and it's gone in different directions. I compliment you on your ability to take the stream where it goes. Nice job. Thank you. None of this was intended to be goofing around. It's a question I've been pondering and trying to answer. I got some good input tonight. I suggest you go to a different topic if we have any time. But I thank you for the good job that you do.
Really, 1,000%.
Totally agree.
Okay. What can I tell you? I'm a big fan of who's on first, what's on second. So it kind of reminds me of the good old days.
Although, Roy, I have some collateral sessions for one thing you said.
AG2RY.
Yeah, feel free. Ed, what do you want to take exceptions of?
Coming up with the right inductors is thought out mathematically correct. But there are so many variables that then you're 100% right. Just throw all of that out the window.
Again, it falls under those, you know, theoretical versus practical. In the theoretical world, I could Google it, and I'll get an equation of how to calculate the inductance of a given piece of wire made into coils of a given diameter and all the other little variables. When push comes to shove, there's too many real variables that we can't take into consideration. And so, when it comes to capacitors, they're rather simple and easy. You basically buy them and plug them in. Pre-built inductors, it's a lab experiment at best.
One could also say that antenna science is very complex.
It's very complex.
What you said is?
In terms of what?
Complex variables. You know, the J omega.
Yeah.
It involves imaginary numbers, real and imaginary components. Everything in antennas is real and imaginary components. That's known as complex math.
Yeah, and I did a science talk on that many, many years ago. That's only the first level. There are increasing complex numbers beyond the simple I or J. I think, once again, mathematicians like physicists are not really good at naming things. I would probably name it as an alternative number line rather than an imaginary one because you know, a lot of people actually think it's imaginary, but obviously it works in physics. So it's just an alternate number line that doesn't coincide with the natural number line.
It all has to do with spaceship.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, it has to do with a lot of things that are vectors and not scalars. A lot of guys aren't taught vectors, and so they kind of reduce vectors to scalars. And we do it all the time with impedances. Very rarely do people mention the phase angle. They mention the absolute impedances and give the value in ohms. But, you know, I mean, that goes into the kind of keep it simple.
This is a subscribe, Alden. And it says if it's not an angle, then you have the real imaginary part.
AG201?
Yes, David?
Well, you know, listening to this conversation, you know, person can be good at science, person can be good at math. They understand the ins and outs of the engineering book, the book of engineering, or, you know, somehow they have some creative way of understanding all of it, and maybe it's a combination of all of those things.
Well, books are what we use to record knowledge that we've gained, and then we go with experiments and theoretical constructs to extend that. We're always kind of standing on the shoulders of giants. And I wouldn't poo-poo books or, you know, I mean, unfortunately, we're living in a weird anti-science civilization, which is strange because, you know, this is probably the golden age of technology, but there's more than enough people gazing at the rocks trying to get bioenergy out of them. So, you know, I don't have... Although, but books are a storage source for knowledge, for correct knowledge and incorrect knowledge. There's a lot of nonsense in some books. You know, nowadays, especially when you can self-publish, you could write a book on the flat Earth.
I think it also has something to do with like what you're looking for. Person is looking for certain information, certain knowledge. Beyond that, you know, a person can, you know, study from a book and then, you know, they can have some real experience. Real experience is more creative and more fulfilling, I think.
I don't know. You know, this is not the philosophy net, so I won't really go too much into fulfillment. Books are good. Books are useful. Good books are better than bad books. Practical experience is good also, but you have to kind of base it with a fundamental understanding of the subject. If you're never school taught electronics and you just tinker around with circuits, you might get a lot of things done. You might know how things work on a cookbook type of level, but you don't quite understand what's going on in the physics of it. And some people don't care. They don't want to know what the physics of it. It just gives them a headache. I find, knowing how everything is working down to quantum level fascinating, even though probably some of it will be disproved. And, you know, that's part of science as well. No one kind of takes science as a given. It's not a Bible. You know, none of these books are Bibles. You're not going to be burned alive as a heretic if you think that there's something a little strange about gravity and you want to do experiments or generate a theoretical model. So, you know, whatever gives you bliss. Mathematicians get a very weird sense of bliss when they're playing with numbers. They live in mathematical terms. They think differently than you or I, but God bless them.
Yeah, I understand. I'm not against science. I think science is very important. I think medicine also very important, you know. Understanding how your radio works, you know, to what extent, and, you know, how do you get the results that you really want, and, you know, how to give to other people something, you know, useful, so that, you know, it's sort of like giving back something to the planet, you know?
Hey, boy, why am I saying I'm flat
earth? Certainly.
Okay. Back in the day, when sailing ships had high mast, so I had high mast to hold the sails, and the air was cleaner, there was less air pollution. We go down to the seaport, find a high place, and watch the sailing ship head out to sea. And as we watched, if the vision was good and the weather was good, we watched the ship slowly sink into the water. The further it got, the more it sank. And then you realize it wasn't sinking, it was going around the first earth. And the problem is, the air pollution doesn't allow us to do that today. So people can't be proved out that the earth is round that simply.
I've seen loads of YouTubes where they show ships disappearing under the horizon. So it's still possible. You know, I mean, not all countries are like China, where you can't see the sky anymore. But, you know, I mean, back in the good old days, people have this distorted belief that Columbus was the only guy who thought the Earth was round. You know, there were Greek philosophers who measured the circumference of the Earth, you know, thousands of years ago. A lot of people saw ships dropping out of the horizon as they got away. Back in the medieval times, most people realized that the Earth was round, and they just kind of didn't think that Asia was as close as Columbus thought. Columbus had no idea that we were here in America, North, Central, and South. And he thought he was going to circumnavigate the globe and not bump into Americas and reach India. And that's why American Indians were called Indians, because the guy thought he was in India.
Columbus clarification when it comes up.
Sure, feel free, Jim.
Columbus as a mariner is an interesting concept. You okay with me exploring that? It gets a little complicated.
Sure. I mean, within reason, if you take out your sextant, that kind of is going over the top, but otherwise, fine.
I'll put my angular equipment away. So Columbus is often talked about as a individual crazed lunatic with a ship. But actually, he was hired by Queen Isabel and King Ferdinand of Spain after they had had an incursion, and the country had been taken over in 711, and they finally kicked out that takeover in 1492, like almost 800 years. And they hired this crazy Italian to sail across around the world to reestablish trade with the rest of the world, because they couldn't reestablish it due to the people that they had just thrown out of their country were still occupying the Mediterranean Sea, and they couldn't access what we've now become now called the Silk Road. I don't know what they called it back then. So there's lots of interesting stuff going on that whole topic. And most of it has to do with Columbus coming here to try to find a way around the occupation of the Mediterranean Sea by others to reestablish the Silk Road trade with what pretty much now is China. Actually, pretty much then was China. Most people don't know what the heck I'm talking about, but that's the way it went. So there's that.
I never heard that. Sounds fascinating and very visual.
Okay, the Silk Road is actually thousands of years old. It was a trade route between India and China and the Middle East. One of the reasons why every so often countries that took over places like Israel was because that was part of the route, and it was very lucrative. And, you know, the ability to tax people when they passed by whatever city-state you happened to bully into running. So the Silk Road's been around for millennia. But the problem was they thought that they were going to sail straight from Europe to Asia. They had no reason to believe that there was a bunch of continents in the way. And when he landed at first, I think he believed the first place was Hispania. He was totally confused by who these people were. He really thought they were Indians.
Agreed. That is certainly the second part of the story. Roy, maybe pass it back to Ed because he had a thought.
Okay, Ed, you had a thought?
No, my original thought from 10 minutes ago was about the Ocean Round. I've heard a lot about Columbus. But I have not heard that because they want to establish alternate trade routes. They said, let's find some person who's crazy enough to try out grand plan of intercept ships the wrong way, to use a hamburger metaphor. But I have heard a lot about whether or not Columbus was had something to do with the Spanish Inquisition. I was in Spain a couple of years ago, and I asked the tour guide. I mean, both Columbus sailing and the Spanish Inquisition were 1492. Is there any link? And the guy says, well, I've lived in Spain all my life. I went through the entire Spanish education system, and the subject never remotely came up. But yet, much more recently, a friend of mine said he had some distant relatives who traced their family history back to Spanish Inquisition, and they say Columbus's crew was Spanish crews looking the hell out of there.
Yeah, I've heard that too, but there's nothing to prove that. They have no documents whatsoever. It's basically hearsay. Some people say that Columbus was Jewish, or he was half Jewish, or he was a convert. When Jim tells the story of the basically, I think the Ottoman Empire. I forget exactly which group they took over Spain, and the Moors were the Muslim who ruled. Spain, and ultimately they were thrown out. The queen of Castile and the king of another province got married and combined the kingdom, and finally threw out all the Muslims, and then they were kind of stuck looking at us poor Jews. And they came to the brilliant idea that, well, we'll give you two choices. Get the heck away from here, or convert to Catholicism. So some of them converted to Catholicism, but some of them kind of fell back, and others didn't fall back, but some people wanted them to be gotten rid of, and so part of that, all the Inquisition, was the converts, and other people that the Roman Catholic Church didn't particularly care for, or the Spanish Crown didn't care for. So that's where some of our Sephardim brothers and sisters kind of came from. They got thrown out of that country. Jews have an unfortunate history of being thrown out of a lot of countries. We've been thrown out of England for a couple of hundred years. I think it was Edward II who actually borrowed a lot of money from Jewish bankers and then threw them out of the country and didn't pay them back. So a very, very interesting field history is.
I concur, yeah, and pretty much sounds like what you've learned. I've pretty much learned the same stuff, but damn close. Important history that nobody knows about, and it's just as important as Half-Wave and Fenantenas, that we should know these things, I think. Back to Roy.
There's another variation on that theme.
Sure. Well, depending upon which theme you're talking about, if it's Jews getting thrown out of a country, there's a lot of variations on that theme.
So this one stands out.
Okay.
In the 1920s, Germany led the world in nuclear research. All the nuclear scientists went to study in Germany. J. Robert Oppenheimer spent a lot of time studying German nuclear science. But then when the Nazis came in, they made a point of throwing out all of the Jewish German nuclear scientists. And that's who worked with Oppenheimer to design the atomic bomb.